Session number 4488, Reel 2.
Brigadier O'Flynn, Reel 2. Did the boat call in anywhere on the way to Alexandria?
Yes, we had 3 ports of call. The first was at Gibraltar, the second at Malta, and the last when we got to Alexandria. Now, when we called at Gib and Malta, all ranks were allowed shore leave from about after lunch until 10 o'clock at night. Now, shore leave meant at that time that draft conducting officers were responsible for giving individual passes to their chaps who were going ashore and making quite certain that those chaps knew they had to report back. I, as a non-draft conducting officer, was free to go as I could. So with Rupert Harding Newman, we went ashore, and as we were going ashore, Rupert, who was a very well-known army rugger player, met some of his naval pals. So I'm afraid I didn't see very much of Gibraltar other than the High Street, and then I think it was HMS Resolution, where we had a very wonderful and enjoyable party with the Navy, and I remember I was very pleased to get on back to the ship at about 8 o'clock to enjoy dinner in peace. The next port of call was Malta, and that was a very interesting place to visit. The sun was shining, and I think it must have been on a Sunday, because my recollection of Malta at that time is the church bells ringing almost the whole time I was there. We went ashore, we took a gharry, and we drove all round the place. And again, I think we met some sailors, and we went to a famous place called the Union Bar, I think it was called in those days. And then as the ship was sailing about 6 or 7 o'clock, I remember we got on board again about 5. And our next port of call was Alex, our final place of calling. And coming to Alex, I know that most of us were most disappointed, because there was a heavy rain falling outside and low clouds, and it didn't look at all like the attractive place we I'd expected to see from the sea.
You said you were living in a large villa in Alexandria. How many other officers were sharing it with you?
Well, the first villa I went to was near Stanley Bay. The night I arrived, there was a large party to meet me. I remember meeting, in addition to Tommy Thompson, R.J. Mansell, who was just about to go off to the Trans-Jordan Frontier Force. Also another officer called Raby Uniac, who was just about to go off to join the Egyptian Frontier District Administration. And there was one other chap on leave from Cairo, and Ian Fernie and Guy Thompson, who were the latter two with the two other officers in the section. My first recollection of that night was that halfway through dinner, there was a loud explosion. I almost jumped off my chair, and Guy Thompson said, "Don't worry, that's somebody being shot." I was rather staggered, and he then reminded me that I had to come abroad with a pistol, which I had to keep loaded. And he said, "I hope you have that in your pocket." And I said, "I haven't." And he said, "Don't let it occur again." And he then made me realize that this requirement that all officers going to Egypt could have a personal 2.8, I think it was, revolver, which I had to carry loaded at all time, was to prevent this possible risk of assassination.
Had you heard of anybody who'd been...
I hadn't heard of it at that time, but I know that after that we went outside and we found that a chap had been shot, but it was an intruder who was trying to get into somewhere. But the result of that was we were then required by the local garrison headquarters to move our villa in that particular district. And 4 days later, we had a much nicer villa at a place called Gliminopolo, which was 7 miles out of Cairo proper, bang on the seafront, in one of the most exclusive areas of Cairo. And our immediate neighbor opposite had to be the brother to the then Secretary of State for Egypt. And it was interesting, because you asked me earlier what was my reaction to the Egyptians. Well, until then, I hadn't thought about it as just people who lived in the country. But as a result of meeting this very charming Egyptian, I then became most attracted to them as a race and to all Arabs, because I found them very gentlemanly and very courteous and very kind. And I also realized in that very meeting, first meeting, that one did not meet the Egyptian ladies, although in this particular case we didn't get to know the young son very well and the young daughter, who were children. And on occasions when we were invited over to have a drink with them, we were very courteously received, including on some occasions by the lady of the house as we arrived.
Can you remember the name of this Egyptian?
Rifat, R-I-F-A-A-T. But I didn't want to start mentioning names in case any repercussions about people. Yes, Rifat. The actual minister of the war was Rifat Pasha.
Apart from Rifat Pasha, did you meet any other Egyptians?
Not in Cairo.
In Alexandria?
In Alexandria. Not in Alexandria. In Cairo, no. Most of the other civilians I met in the area in which we lived were either Britishers who were employed in the, whatever it was, industry out there, or Frenchmen or Greeks. They're the most of the people who inhabited the area in which we lived. There weren't very many Egyptians. And also there wasn't much occasion for us to meet Egyptians, because in those days, as a penniless subaltern, I could hardly afford to exist outside my own little mess, and so I had to spend most of my time, which I enjoyed doing, playing games most afternoons with the soldiers. I captained the cricket team, kept wicket for them, and used to do some cross-country running with them, and used to be an enthusiastic supporter of the soccer team. Because in those days, most of the British soldiers were very active-minded people, and this is the way they kept themselves entertained, because in those days, we worked in the mornings, from Monday to Thursday. Friday was what is called delousing day. Saturday was a day in which everybody carried out all sorts of inspections. And Sunday was our normal religious holiday. So we started work early in those days, at 8 o'clock in the morning, worked until 12 o'clock. It was very hot in the afternoon, so most games and other sporting activities started at about 3 in the afternoon, except in the winter, of course. When I say winter, it is from September to January.
When you said that Friday was debugging day, what did you mean by that?
Well, in those days, when there were not many number of present-day detergents, etc., and one lived a very primitive life in many respects. The big enemies were bugs, woolly bear, and silverfish, I think they were called. These are little insects, or crawly crawlies, that infested your clothing and blankets. And as there was no indoor sort of fans to keep you cool in those days, bugs were very ripe, for the buildings were very old. And so on Friday it meant to say that all bedding had to be taken out and shaken and left in the sun. Barrack rooms had to be cleared of all equipment. And beds, which were mostly of metal construction, had to be wiped over with a thin coating of paraffin. And especially the bed legs had to be wiped down very thoroughly. And most places you had little tobacco tins standing in paraffin to prevent these wretched bugs crawling up the metal of the bedwork. And also one encouraged one's soldiers, as one did one had to do oneself, to turn out all one's woolly clothing, one's uniform, air it, shake it, because if one didn't, one left it a fortnight, you'll probably find a nasty hole in it, like a moth hole, but bitten by one of these little creepy crawlies. And it was taken very, very seriously. So that used to take the whole of Friday morning, and then Friday afternoon was the usual sort of rest and sporting activity.
Where were the men's barracks?
The men were barracked adjoining the infantry battalion Mustafa barracks. They had a proper barrack room up on the first floor. They had their own little dining room and kitchen on the ground floor, and they had their own reception room. Although they mixed a lot in the Wiltshire's canteen, so it has always have been, rather insular, and preparing to have their own sort of private barrack room, the private recreation rooms.
How many of them were there at the time?
That section had just under 40 chaps, because we had the armoured car crews, the five crews of the car, and a crew normally consisted of about six people, the four standard crew and the... the driver mechanic and things like that. And then you had the extra chaps you had on the section, the cooks and the storemen, because we had to have our own special stores like that and the ammunition things. So in all, the section was about 40 chaps, which included the armoured car crews plus the scout car, the staff car driver. And various other chaps who had special duties, like the chap who was trained in first aid. We had a first trained orderly, but of course the doctor was provided by the Wiltshire Regiment, whose barracks were, I say, adjoining our little barracks. We, as the officers, occasionally used the Wiltshire officers' mess. We were always very welcome to do so, but we preferred our own mess. And
what like sort of messing arrangements did you have?
Well, we had to run our own messing arrangements. As I say earlier on, in those days before the war, when there was no sort of marriage allowance, officers were either accommodated or they were not accommodated. If they were not accommodated, and they could not be accommodated in the mess, they were entitled to certain allowances. These included the ration allowance, the lodging allowance, the furniture allowance, and the heat, fuel, and light allowance. And as far as I can remember, on checking out some of my past bank statements, which I still have, I found that my allowances a month as a second lieutenant in those days amounted to £30 sterling, as against my pay of £15 10 a month for a 31-day month. So therefore, as we were running this flat, the three of us were entitled to these allowances. We had to pay for the rent of the flat ourselves, and we had to make our own catering arrangements and cooking arrangements. Now, we were entitled to, the captain was entitled to one Egyptian servant, and the two subalterns were allowed to one between them. So that gave us two suffragis, and we also had to hire a cook and a cook boy. Now, Ian Fernie and myself had to run the mess a month in, a month about. And we did it. We took over on the first day of each month. And thereafter, whoever was running the mess had to interview the cook and the head suffragi before we went to work each day at about 7:45. And we then decided what we were going to eat the following day, or any particular entertainment we were going to do during the next 7 days, find out what he would have to buy, what he had left in the kitty from yesterday in the rate of goods, and then pay him cash to buy that day's requirements. This was not difficult, because as a young officer in the 3rd Battalion, I'd always had to do my stint as assistant messing officer, and I knew exactly how to keep, I think the thing was called the AB 48 or 64, which is the thing we had to keep in those days, which had to show exactly what rations you had in stock, what you were going to buy, and what you were going to spend. So as a result of this, then having seen the cook and the head suffragi, the rations would be bought by the chap and he wanted them. We were not drawing food in kind at that time from the mess. We were drawing the whole cash issue, which made it simpler. And at the end of the week, I had to tot up the book and present it to the section commander to satisfy him that we were not running into debt and that we were providing on the daily menu I had to prepare what we had purchased. It was a very simple arrangement, and it worked very well. We also, of course, being in that private flat, had to expect a large number of people wanting to come and stay with us. And so we had a roaster, the friends from the 3rd Armoured Car Company, and also the 12th Royal Lancers, who were about to take over from us, had the right to write and say, could they come and stay? And if so, fix the dates. And we could say, yes, you can. And they used to come and used to pay their mess room and go on again. So it was a very satisfactory arrangement.
Did the men have Egyptian servants as well?
I cannot remember, yes, the precise number, but I know that the PRI, which is the president of the Regimental Institute, used to, from the squadron headquarters, used to allow us a sum of money to pay for the employment. I think it was 2 or 3 orderlies, and these orderlies had to do certain menial tasks about the barrack room and keep the soldiers' quarters clean. I can't remember the actual numbers now, but it was 2 or 3. And I had to pay those chaps, but of course the employment of those chaps was left to the troop sergeant, Sergeant Kellaway, who was more or less, he was a local sort of senior NCO down there. He was assisted by another sergeant, Sergeant Pilbrow, who used to be responsible for all the administration that would be done by the company quartermaster sergeant or squadron quartermaster sergeant in the squadron for this particular section. And the whole thing worked very well because every Saturday, as I say, inspections in those days were very, very thorough. Everything was checked by either Guy Thompson or Ian Fernie or myself. We each had responsibilities which would be supervised by the section commander, who was very hot. There was no damn nonsense about it. A thing was either right or wrong. And if it was wrong, you knew about it.
What did these inspections consist in?
Well, first of all, there was the equipment efficiency. We had no EME staff or ordnance E, as it was in those days, to inspect vehicles. We had to inspect our own vehicles for cleanliness, tool checks, kit checks, because not only did things get lost, but things got stolen. Because one of the worries down there were the people we call the loose wallets. These Arabs or these Egyptians who used to pinch whatever they saw. And therefore one had to have a constant check that everybody's equipment was up to date and not deficient. It was merely a question to satisfy all concerned, because a soldier couldn't be checking his kit all the time. So we had these checks made quite certain, because it was a very real threat. And I should say another big difference in those days from those days, whenever an armoured car finished its day's work, it was fully equipped and with full tanks and mechanically roadworthy. If ever a vehicle at the end of the day was found not to be roadworthy, then the crew had to work on it all night and keep it on. That included the officer. So whenever we left the vehicle and went to bed, we knew the vehicle would be perfectly fit to go out to bed the following morning. Because it's often forgotten that in those days, we were out there with a purpose. We were out there, firstly, to maintain and support the maintenance of internal security, and second, in the armoured car region, we had to be prepared at short notice to go into the desert for some untoward incident or for some special reconnaissance required, and that all the troops out there had immediate internal security roles which would have to be filled in some cases within 30 seconds of the balloon going up.
Did the balloon ever go up when you were there?
Yes, it did. But on neither occasion were we called out, because armoured cars were used either as a last resort, and in each case we had to stand by. And I remember the section leader going out to do a reconnaissance, but neither of the occasions I can remember did we have to go out. The infantry battalion had to go out, but we didn't have to move.
What sort of duties did it involve then, the internal security side of things?
Well, giving actually details over all this passage of time is a bit difficult. But firstly, there was a thing I remember called the Green Line, which was a green line beyond which British troops were not allowed to go. And we had to patrol that line down its centre once each week. And there were also a number of of vulnerable points, they were called, the VPs, which we had to know pretty well. So if an emergency, in the middle of the night, we had to get out, we knew how to get there by the quickest possible means.
What sort of things were these vulnerable points?
The telephone exchanges, and I can't remember all the details now, because as a young officer, that didn't mean a great deal to me. You see, we had to get to a certain place in a certain time and do something and leave it at that. But at that time, as a young chap of just 21, 22, one didn't have the detailed investigative requirement one has in these later times. But there were a number of vulnerable points, both in and outside Alexandria. I was much more interested in those outside Alexandria, actually, the various points where it could be trouble one had to go to. But when I had to do my periodical patrols within inside what I call the somewhat smelliest part of Alexandria, I found it very unpleasant and very vomit-making. So after a time, I found it was essential to carry a bottle of eau de cologne, because when we went into some of these smelly quarters, they were pretty high, especially around the back of the dock areas.
What was the reaction of the local population?
Nothing. They just used to stand and sometimes chat with shout, but otherwise it was never whatever it was. And they used to wave, and we used to wave back. And I have found all my time in dealing with the Arabs that if you smile and you look happy and you wave to him, he'll probably wave back at you. But I can never remember any unpleasant instance in Alexandria or in Egypt in dealing with the Arabs.
Did you have any special training to deal with internal disorders?
Oh, yes, one had lectures. And, of course, when I first went out, I wasn't allowed out alone. I mean, the first four or five times I went out, I always had to go out with either Guy Thompson, the section leader, or Ian Fanny. And there was no question just sending a chap out not knowing the way before one went out to take out the section. But normally we set out half sections, two cars at a time. One didn't send out the whole five. In fact, when we did patrols in the desert, which I haven't mentioned yet, we normally had three cars going out. One subsection had to stay back in barracks, but as I've said, we had certain internal security tasks which might have to be performed within half an hour. And therefore, if there was any question of the armoured cars as a whole, as we did on one occasion, I remember the whole section having to go to the Saloum frontier, then alternative arrangements had to be made for carrying our particular task in the event of it. But the one particular incident I remember wasn't a particularly offensive one. It was the High Commissioner wanted to inspect, as far as I can remember, something on the Saloum frontier. And the whole section had to go out to escort him and General Lindsay, who was a BGS, Brigadier General Lindsay, provide the escort for the High did I say High Commissioner? I should have said the GOC&C. It's a Peter Strickland. No, it wasn't High. It was Sir Peter Strickland who went out with the BGS to do certain inspections on the Saloum frontier, and the whole section went out as his escort.
I'd like to ask you now about the armoured cars themselves. Can you describe one to me?
The Rolls-Royce armoured car was the most famous armoured car. It really first came into being, I think, during the First World War. I'm not certain, but I think the Duke of Westminster's Armoured Car Company had them originally. But in 1920, as a result of unrest in different parts of the world where British troops were engaged, commanders-in-chiefs were becoming increasingly demanding to have armoured cars, which they realised that one armoured car section of five cars would probably be able to do what a whole battalion of troops could do on the ground. And so in 1920, as the machine gun corps was being disbanded, the Royal Tank Corps was expanded by forming a number of armoured car companies. And number three company, which I joined, was formed in 1920 and moved to Egypt later that year, or early 21, with another two companies who went to Palestine and Iraq. It was a standard Rolls-Royce engine mounted on four wheels with an armoured body which covered the engine, the driving compartment with a little turret on the top, and a rear into the car, which went over its exhaust pipe, on which was a wooden platform with two boxes and an armoured door sealing off a turret compartment and whatever it was. Not a good description, but I can show you a picture of it. Now, these cars carried a crew of four: the driver, the co-driver, the commander, who either stood on the back or put his head through the turret, and the machine gunner, who sat on a little thing behind the turret. And the gun was mounted in a turret mounting which could do a 360-degree TAVIS. Now, it had been found, in spite of many opinions of the country, that these armoured cars had a considerable effect on quietening crowds. And during the period from 1920 onwards, 12 armoured car companies were formed, 8% to Egypt, 8% to India. One went out to Shanghai, having been in this country, and two were in Iraq. And one of those armoured cars, or one of the troops of those armoured cars, helped to make the famous marked track across the desert, which Imperial Airways had to follow when they started flying the aircraft to Iraq.
What sort of equipment, did they have any special equipment to deal with crowds?
Not really, not officially. The only equipment they had was a gun, but otherwise it was merely, I think, trying to, by the mere appearance of them. But it could be tricky at times when you were in a demonstration. The chaps would try to jump on your car, and then you had some method of putting an electrical charge from the batteries carried on the car, I can't remember how it was done now, into the armour plating, which gave the chap not a nasty shock, but a slight tingling which made him take his hands off. And some of the crews, quite irregularly, also had the things they called wog prodders. We didn't use those in Egypt, but I gather they were used in India. That it was the metal rod that used for clearing a machine gun head. You had occasion to push a steel rod down the barrel, and using that as a little prodding weapon if a chap got too close and tried to become offensive. But I remember, and I don't remember any of those incidents happening in Cairo. I remember that when a few occasions, having heard from my friends who had to take armoured cars out, the mere fact they were there helped to quieten them all.
Did you have any specific problems with the armoured cars themselves in Egypt?
No, only when they happened to run into a sand drift. Then we had special drills. We carried special channels, metal channels on the side of the car. So if the car got stuck, it would be a question of getting out our spades and our shovels, trying to dig a little space under the tire, which was, and insert the channel and get the car back to reverse onto the channel and get out again. But they were very, very reliable cars. I don't remember during the top 4 months I was in the company ever having any serious breakdowns. The only times I remember the cars being off the road were when we had to carry out engine changes or taking it off the top of the engine to do something to it. But otherwise, it's true to its name, a Rolls Royce, but that's really perfect.
Did you have to know as much about the engines as everyone else in the squad?
Yes, because as I said earlier on, that when one joined the Royal Tank Corps, one had to do courses in these things, one had to pass out. And of course, being a member of the crew, one was a member of the crew. One just wasn't the chap who stood on one side. And I remember the main jobs of the turret crew. The turret crew consisted of the operator and the commander was to change the ruddy tires.
Were there any workshops that you used to take the cars to?
We had no workshops in Alexandria. We had to send our cars, if they required workshop attention, up to the workshops in Cairo. But that was at that time. I can't remember what happened at that time, but I don't remember during the time I was in the section, one of our section cars having to go into workshops.
You mentioned desert patrols before. What did that involve?
Yes. As we were the only armoured car detachment left at that time, the other two troops in Cairo having handed over their vehicles to the 12th Lancers, who were still under training, we had the responsibility of doing certain essential patrols in the western desert between Alexandria and Saloum, going through Mers Matru and Sidi Barani and those sort of places. Because it was still a hostile atmosphere. There was still the Senussis in the east, in the west rather, and Libya, and we had to keep a constant watch on the coastline and the frontier.
Why was that?
Well, because it was, there was always certain tension in the Middle East. We were an occupying force in those days, and also we had to know the desert. Because had there been any trouble and the infantry brigade having to go out there, we would have had to provide the first protective screen. And so it was essential that we, as the last remaining armoured car sub-unit, until the 12th Lancers were fully equipped, had to know our way across the desert. We had to know the correct routes to take. We had to move south of the desert into south of places like Sidi Barani and Mers Matru, down towards them. I can't remember all the names now, but there are many of the wadis and places that became quite famous during the 1939-39 war. And also, we had to have somebody trained who could explain and pass on to the 12th Lancers when they took on how to live in the desert. There was nothing there. There were all sorts of things you had to learn. You had to learn how to recognize different sorts of soil. It was no use trying to go through a bit of obviously going to be deep sand, because the desert wasn't just one great sand sea. The desert consisted of sand, shrubland, and all sorts of land. And therefore we had to know our ways about. We had to know various sort of shortcuts from different paces through various waters. We had to go down to a place called Siwa.